From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 487, VM and Cloud Management with guest John Middlehauser. Recorded Monday, July 25th, 2016. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is John Middlehauser, who is the CEO of CloudBolt Software, and he's considered one of the founding fathers of the World Wide Web, as he was the co-author of the first widely used web browser, NCA Mosaic, as well as the founding engineer of Netscape Communications Corporation. As Netscape Navigator's first project manager, Middlehauser led the effort to create a browser that actually integrated in technologies like the browser plugins, Java, JavaScript, which, thank you, sir, because it still runs the internet today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Yeah, and yeah, thanks for being right. That was a good right.
Yes. I mean, I now when I describe it, I talk about sort of the platformization of the browser, because back then, you know, sort of the first browsers were just for consuming information, just kind of a one-way traffic. And then that sort of 2.0 effort that we led of Netscape was really making it two-way.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Berners-Lee, and I've met the man, a lovely guy, no two ways about it, but a scientist who wanted dynamically linking documents. I mean, that's what he cared about. That was his vision. It was you guys at Netscape who really said, you know, this could be the host for any kind of application.
Yeah. I mean, and in fact, sort of NCSA Mosaic was my master's thesis back at Illinois with Mark Andreessen and the others. And we really saw what Tim had done and said, hey, that's kind of cool. But I think we were all much more pragmatic, you know, Midwest boys who kind of, you know, wanted practical things in there. So, you know, Tim, for example, fought against inline images, which, you know, as far as we were concerned, was sort of integral to making this thing look good and be useful. And obviously, right. If you look at the web today, it's a fairly visual media, which, yes. We all fought hard for.
Well, TBL also thought XML was a good idea, and we proved him wrong on that one, too.
Right? Yeah, yes, exactly. Right. I mean, it is a bit of that sort of European standards base versus sort of pragmatic Silicon Valley or Midwest.
I think the American culture of put it out there and watch crazy things happen has proven powerful. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, there's so many things that we did that now there's buzzwords or terms about that, you know, we just did because we thought they were right things. I mean, kind of agile development and all that. I mean, we were, mm-hmm. I mean, for Mosaic, we were just kids. So, you know, we would write some code and we'd throw it out every other day and people would use it and we'd take their feedback and we'd integrate it and we'd fix bugs and we'd take their ideas. And I mean, that was just the way that made sense to do things. And now there's, you know, books and seminars.
Yeah, we write books. Yeah, your stand-ups involved beer, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, technically, we were, you know, at a NSF-funded supercomputing center. So, you know, the beer was usually off-site, just, you know, but yes.
I remember connecting to the original IRC server in Urbana. And every so often, it would go wonky because the internet was relatively fragile then. And you'd sort of split the two internets. You know, half the people could see one part of the conversation. The other half could see other parts. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
Just hanging together at that time.
Yes, exactly. And just a little bit slower than it is today things. Yes.
But our expectations were lower, too. I mean, just the... Oh man, the size of web pages, and it's unbelievable. Gee, you're unhappy at your page performance? You know your page is a gigabyte, right?
Right, yeah. Well, you know, one of the main things we did moving from, you know, Mosaic, which we kind of just did ad hoc, as I said, kind of as ideas. I mean, it was great to found Netscape because what we got to do was basically start over. And this is what engineers normally don't get to do is look at what we had done, kind of where we were and say, you know, what were all the mistakes we made? So, you know, one of the main features of Netscape, which caused it to kind of explode in terms of popularity was how we treated, you know, web pages and basically, you know, now everything does it, but kind of dynamically laying them out and showing you content as quickly as possible. And, you know, that, as opposed to waiting for everything to, you know, every single last bit to load before you displayed anything. So we couldn't move bits any faster. Obviously, we didn't change physics, but the perception was that we were order of magnitude faster than
that gradual rendering effect, which is just, again, take for granted now.
Yeah.
It was an innovative idea at that time. Could you have predicted the cloud? I mean, it's kind of insane where we are now compared to then.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's a buzzword, the cloud, right? But even back then, what we talked about was, I mean, it's science fiction predicted it long before we did.
Sure.
Right? So it was basically, you know, even when I would talk about it in early Netscape days, and I was a product manager, so I spent a fair amount of time trying to explain to people what the web was, what the internet was. You know, one of my fallbacks was just, think about Star Trek, think about science fiction. Any information that is available, that is known, is available at your fingertips. And so at 10,000 foot level, yes, everything you want to know, you can get instantly. That level of description, for sure. Obviously, the level at which it would change every aspect of life, shopping and politics and culture and stuff. I don't think we thought exactly the thing we were building would do it, but I use this term inevitable technology. I believe that the web or some form of that was inevitable, and that's why you saw it in science fiction, right? The exact protocols and how we did it. I mean, all that's variable, right?
And once you start connecting computers together, eventually you think, you know, every time we connect more computers together, it just gets better. Let's connect them all together.
Exactly. And I, you know, one of the things I sort of alluded to, the political, that was something that I didn't give enough thought to, and I think has been fascinating. And
I don't know how we did elections without the internet before. It's just baffling to me. And I was alive then. I was voting then.
Yeah. And where I see it, I mean, I've got kids now and I'm an old man, but is kind of the youth and sort of the awareness of what's going on. And in this country, there was always a bit of it, but around the world, so many people only were exposed to the ideas of the people who lived within 10 miles of them.
Right.
And now they can access, you know, ideas and thoughts and stuff, even in places where governments have tried to prevent it, from all over the world. And that led to, you know, geopolitical changes, you know, Arab Spring and stuff that I had never anticipated that is amazing, right?
It's kind of, it's hard to resist the fact that, well, you can spread a lot of dumb stuff on the internet. The truth tends to win.
Yeah. And just being exposed to people who think differently than you tends to, hopefully, this is my optimism showing through. Mm-hmm. There's some obviously rebounds in political aspects that are going on around the world. But
yes,
in general, and I think you see it when you look at sort of by age and by technology savvy and stuff, that being exposed to other ideas is usually a positive net.
Yeah. It's absolutely true, and it's accumulated into this incredible space that we're in now. That, I don't know, my job is radically different than it used to be. I'm sure yours has changed tremendously too. Just because you were in on some of the parts of the beginning, you know, it's hard to keep track of all the different pieces that are being thrown at us now.
Yeah, and you know, to address the cloud in particular, I mean, what you've seen back in 94 when we started up Netscape, you know, to start up a company, to do a new technology, you had to build everything soup to nuts.
Right.
You had to build racks of servers and you had to implement all the underlying technologies. And we literally coded up, well, at NCSA, I was coding up sort of, you know, low level transport protocol sockets.
Yep.
For folks who know what that is before, because this was pre-WinSock to lead it back to Microsoft technologies. But now what you've seen is all of these underlying technologies where, you know, I'm in Silicon Valley. I see folks start up a company with no money, no resources, and have a product out there because they're leveraging cloud technologies like Azure that give them such a bootstrap that they can focus on simply kind of what their value add is on top of. They don't have to worry about where they get compute and where they get storage and how they talk to things. And they can leverage all of that other technologies via APIs, et cetera, et cetera. I think it lends itself to much quicker innovation, and we're seeing that now.
Yeah, I think it's true. It doesn't even have to be the startup now. Any organization that has an idea can utilize the cloud to just sort of launch the minimum infrastructure necessary to try that idea for a while. It's interesting that our internal infrastructure is just not that agile, that you, it's easier to go to AWS and light up a site than it is to do it at home.
Yeah. Well, and that, to take it back to what I'm doing now, one of the, what CloudBolt is a management platform across all of your internal and external cloud and virtualization. So, you know, these large enterprises tend to have a large VMware installation, and then they're exploring various public clouds, and some of them are very advanced and some of them are just starting, Azure, AWS, et cetera. But it's exactly what you just alluded to, which is historically that internal infrastructure wasn't able to kind of be an on-demand the way the cloud was. And
sure,
by putting something, a management platform like CloudBolt on top of that, that's what folks are able to do. They're able to give kind of that simple interface to end users that provide self-service. Hey, I need a server. I need a database. I need a service. And frankly, that end user shouldn't care whether that's coming from the internal VMware virtualization or whether that's coming from Azure or some other technology. Maybe it's using a Chef underneath. Maybe it's using Docker and Kubernetes and containers underneath.
Right.
But that end user doesn't care. They certainly don't want to be trained up on particular sort of interfaces that may change. And from an IT admin standpoint, you know, who I think is a fair amount of your listening audience, they don't want to expose that complexity to those end users.
Well, this comes back to this idea that cloud is as much an architecture as it is a product.
Of course.
And we did not adopt virtualization for this. I adopted virtualization in my organizations because it reduced my server footprint. I'm using servers more efficiently. I'm not beholden to any given piece of hardware. I can move those VMs around. You know, gone are the days of I'm afraid of that machine now because it has a vital service on it, but it's outside of warranty and nobody's willing to touch it.
Yep.
Like, that's all been eliminated.
Yeah, it provides flexibility both in terms of, as you say, sort of maximizing efficiency and handling spikes of demand, handling capacity needs. You don't have to pay to over provision for your peaks anymore, right? You're
right.
Paying for actual usage. And also that flexibility, this is where time comes into it, where we've got customers who kind of the classic enterprise IT mechanism is, oh, I need a server. I put in a help desk request. I wait days to weeks. We've had some customers where the average time was actually months.
Right.
And that's because they may need to order a server and there's a different group who does that. Then they have to provision it. Then that, you know, there's a network groups and a data group and all these kind of barriers. Because of that, that end user, they only do it when it's necessary, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's critical. But when it's a simple cloud technology or you provide that on top of your existing infrastructure, then somebody can say, hey, I've got a great idea. They can spin it up. They can try it in a matter of minutes. That leads to that quick innovation cycle we were alluding to earlier.
Yeah. It all sort of feeds together. But it's very interesting to think in terms of what are the architectural elements of going from your VMs to a cloud architecture that makes your VMs act like AWS's VMs act.
This is where I think some people try to just kind of wave a magic wand and say, oh, I'm going to move everything to the cloud. But really, if you're talking legacy software, it to some degree, it doesn't matter
yeah.
where it's running. You're not getting the benefits, right? I mean, it's really to take advantage of cloud architecture, you need to re-architect applications as well.
Sure.
And that's that transition that's happening over time. And some of it is that, you know, people are rewriting applications. Some of it that people are creating new applications. I mean, obviously the large successful SaaS companies have basically replaced, if you take a Salesforce or any of the large companies, that's a new application that was kind of architected from the cloud to start with, or, you know, even entertainment technologies, the Netflixes of the world, or the on-demand companies, the Ubers of the world. I mean, these are things that are inherently sort of cloud architected from the start, whereas some of these older technologies, basically the difference between a cloud architecture and a legacy architecture the simplest difference to me is that a legacy architecture software program makes the assumption that infrastructure it's running on won't fail. And when it does fail, things go bad.
Right.
And so then you get into these worlds where people try to run, you know, multiple copies and hot and failovers and stuff. Whereas something that's truly architected for the cloud has the assumption that the underlying architecture will fail, but the application won't.
Yeah, the application represents the resiliency given sufficient hardware. You keep moving around.
Yep.
And it's a very different way to think, and you just don't get it for free. I would also point out on my last week's show, I said, we never need to write another CRM again, ever, ever, ever. Just stop doing it. It's done. You know, you buy it per seat, per month from several different providers. You know, it's over. And I kind of like that idea that we're putting software to bed. It's just a product you buy, like paper for your copier and electricity for your rooms.
Yeah. Although I bet I could wander down the road up to Sand Hill and there's probably five people pitching CRMs to the VCs this week, right? I mean,
there's a better way to do it.
Yeah. So, you thought chat was a fairly solved problem and then Slack came along and they didn't do anything fundamentally different. They just did things better, right?
Yeah. And it had a huge impact. John, give me one second here to pay the bills because this episode of Run As Radio is brought to you by UpGuard. In the aftermath of data breaches, the public is often told, we just couldn't have seen it coming. But in a lot of cases, that's not true. Over 80% of breaches have their root in misconfiguration, whether it is a firewall rule, a server setting, open port, or third-party service. UpGuard is a premier system of record for IT configurations. No matter the platform, pinpointing anomalies and surfacing unauthorized changes in critical systems around the world. See how it works and get a live, customized demo at upguard.com/runasradio. Okay, I mean, I'm in. I like this idea. I still run a couple of servers at home, which I've now set up as VMs, and I'm making them cloud-ish. You know, I can float by the different services I'm running between them. You know, nothing's ever down anymore. You build a new one and restore onto it. You know, do your backups, that kind of thing.
Yep.
But I think in the larger settings, it's got to get challenging to start thinking about, you know, how do I get that confident with my VMs?
In what context?
Just, you know, that no virtual machine is pristine. You know, over on the cloud world, I'm at the cattle phase now with my cloud-based projects where I never update a server anymore. I build a new set of servers from scripts and shoot the old ones and move the traffic over.
Yeah, and that's the recommended behavior that we try to help our customers get to. And mm-hmm. and we really, this is where CloudBolt is a software package. We leverage underlying infrastructures like Chef and Puppet and, you know, automation technologies because what you want is that mentality we talked about with cloud where everything can do that and can be rebuilt from scratch. So your data is living in the cloud, your VMs are living in your cloud, your infrastructure is living. And that gives that IT department the flexibility to move it to somewhere that's less busy, that's less expensive, it's back to that flexibility we talked about. You know, mm-hmm. This is also where the cloud scaling, cloud bursting comes in. I don't even need to have my internal infrastructure large enough to handle the peaks where I can own the base, rent the spikes.
Yes.
You know, I can have my virtualization technology, my VMware handling my day to day. But, you know, whether it's a seasonal thing, we see a lot of traction within retail, for example, you know, their usage is incredibly seasonal, right? Around, you know, Black Friday, they need to have, you know, a lot more resources than the middle of summer.
Yeah. You don't want a provision for peak when it's three times the median.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't want to spend for it that much money. Exactly.
It's just money.
And you don't necessarily want to commit to the other reason they like technology that gives them flexibility is things change over time. So the best way of doing it, and best can be defined by price, it can be defined by security, it can be defined by latency, etc., depends on the application, that changes over time. So it may be that today that internal, tomorrow it may be Azure or AWS, but and the underlying infrastructure could change to containers. I want the flexibility to change that without changing how it's facing the end user. So, you know, the web has done that, right? You don't have any visibility into what technologies are under the sites you're going to or the applications built on top of the infrastructure. You know, folks don't, they just interface Netflix through their web browser or through their Xbox, right?
Right.
They don't have any visibility to the fact that that's running on AWS or other cloud technologies.
No, they don't need to know.
And exactly. So what you want to do is expose kind of at various levels, just what they need to know. So, you know, an admin may need to know all the way down to sort of the price and how much RAM and other things. A developer may want choice of RAM and disk, but We've got customers, for example, using Cloud Bolt as a way of deploying to salespeople. So imagine a salesperson who's got a product they want to demo through technology screen sharing.
Sure.
You know, Skype, GoToMeeting. The company in question has like 10 variations of the product running on different operating systems with different options. They've got, 50 salespeople. They'd have to have 500 plus VMs running all those variations for all those salespeople 24/7 if they just wanted a infrastructure up for them to demo. Instead, what they do today now is they give that salesperson a simple dialog box that says, hey, what version do you want to demo? What operating system? What options? The salesperson hits a button. It provisions it out. It launches it. It text messages them back a link. They use or emails them a link. They do their GoToMeeting demo. And then an hour later, it expires that virtual machine. That salesperson didn't care that was being deployed on VMware or Azure or any of that. The IT admin cares because it affects security and costs. But that's that exposing the complexity at the right level as you go.
Yeah, nobody actually wants a 24/7 service. They just want service when we want service.
Exactly.
I'll say 24/7 so that the 15 minutes a month that I want your product, it's available. But actually, I just want that 15 minutes. That's kind of the truth of that matter. I want to hammer into this whole burst model. So you're a large retailer running on-prem 9-10 months of the year, but coming into your peak season, you want to handle the spikes into the cloud. Does that actually mean you switch those sites to the cloud for those time periods and then pull them back in after the fact?
Usually, when you're talking that particular example, what you're talking is into your service where the presentation, the websites are separate from the data, separate from the ordering.
Right.
And so what you're really scaling up is particular tiers of the service, right?
Right. The browsing side of the site goes into the cloud. Ordering could still be internal.
Yeah, though you may need to scale up the ordering as well. But some of the way you can do that is by shifting other resources, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it's again, you're scaling up on demand the pieces that need it.
I just don't buy into this idea that half my website be running on-prem and half of it running on the cloud, at least vertically, maybe horizontally. Horizontally, it's just like, okay, the front-end servers are in the cloud, but the back-end stuff, just the database is still on-prem.
Yeah, we've seen it done various ways. And this is definitely kind of that bleeding edge that
right.
folks are working with and moving forward. But what it really comes down to is that you want to eliminate the distinctions kind of what's running where and
where the edges are.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where sort of, software defined networking technologies, VMware's NSX and the public cloud providers technologies to do that. The distinction, when you say on-prem for a lot of these enterprises, it's not really on-prem per se.
Right.
It's in a data center run by somebody else. It's just kind of who's owning those servers.
Yeah, it's Rackspace or one of the other big service providers.
So the only distinction at the end of the day really is the networking.
Right.
And that's where the software-defined networking comes in, where...
And the billing model.
And the billing model. Yeah, so fair enough. Yeah, exactly. If, Azure provides that same type of service and you have the software-defined networking, there's not really a distinction from a technical standpoint between internal and external. It's more a distinction between, networking, billing, and those different aspects of the service.
Although when I look at the different products, when I look at Amazon and at Azure, the only commonality is the VM. I should be able to create VMs with this common code base in all of these different places. And then it's almost like it's the dollar power by the hour pricing that matters to me.
Yeah. The VM is obviously, sort of not to get too basic here, but there's compute, storage, and networking,
yep.
Right? And all of them have aspects of that and all of them have different technologies, but basically, I need compute on demand and I need storage on demand in different forms. And I need to be able to control the networking between my compute and my storage and my consumers. And so it's various knobs of those three core technologies. The most common aspect today is simply I need a VM. And,
right.
And as you kind of alluded to, what you want is the ability to kind of spin those up, shut them down on demand without necessarily worrying about all of the fine little details or the distinctions between the different cloud providers. And that's where our technology comes in and why folks use us.
Right. It's that you create that level of abstraction above all that.
Exactly.
Because I look at products like Kubernetes and Mesosphere. Like, I think there's a bunch of folks thinking in the space of how do I package up services for applications in a way that the underlying infrastructure can change and I don't care.
Yeah. Well, so kind of the difference is simply scale and timing. So, you know, we were in a world where it was all physical machines and you tended to have, you know, you ordered a physical machine and it lived for years.
Yes.
as a physical machine. Then we kind of got to virtualization, basic VMs, kind of internal, usually, you know, VMware being the canonical example, and you would spin up VMs, but they still would live months to years. Cloud kind of VMs, you know, if you look at how Netflix or others use cloud VMs, those tend to live days to hours. Containers, kind of the architecture is microseconds, seconds. And so it's all you're really changing. But again, it comes back to its compute, right? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I want to do some work for a certain amount of time. Kind of the compute as a service or a code as a service type things like AWS and Lambda is that mentality as well. You know, hey, I as a developer don't want to worry about individual, like I don't have to worry about underlying how much RAM it has and disk and that type of thing. I just want something that's going to run my code.
Right.
So it's all a spectrum.
Well, and it's interesting that in every stage of this evolution, it's just gotten shorter and shorter and shorter. Like, what's short enough?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, you said it exactly, which is I simply want resources when I need them.
Right.
And so if I can do, you know, the finer grain I can slice and dice that, the better I can kind of map the effectiveness, the costs to my usage. You know, in a lot of cases, I do think the VMs is a simple enough technology. Now, the other aspect of this is, you know, kind of starting as a software engineer and manager, modularization is kind of key. And that's this aspect that the smaller the pieces are, the easier it is for me to test, debug, and improve incrementally. So,
right.
You know, we'll go back to kind of talking about the way we did things back in 94 in the dark ages. We had to build up all the server infrastructure. We had to write all, you know, other than sort of a base OS, we wrote every layer of that. You know, frankly, it was all spaghetti. And we tried our best and we did a pretty good job back then of abstract and modularizing these things. But what it meant was you couldn't touch, you know, one aspect of, oh, I want to support a new image format, PNG, without running the risk that you're breaking everything.
Sure.
Now, you know, the more I can abstract these things behind APIs, it allows me to independently test, develop, and improve each little piece. One of the pushes for containers is just making even those pieces smaller, because then I can incrementally, I can have different groups testing. But I've never, you know, as much as I like Docker and Kubernetes and some of these technologies, I haven't quite bought, to be frank, the marketing hype that this is revolutionary. To me, it's an evolution.
Well, I see two things here. I mean, it's how you build your VM in the first place that decides, you know, how long-lived that VM needs to be. If you've got something like Puppet or Chef behind you, so that you're literally going from the bare metal commands to instantiate the VM, install the OS, and configure the whole thing, and it's done. I mean, that's as flexible as you need it to be. It does what you're supposed to do. In my mind, the only difference between a container and a VM at that point is where does the OS live? And the fact that containers were built from the outset as this configuration as code mindset.
Yep.
But you can do config as code on VMs just fine.
Yeah, and I agree with that for the most part. One of the things it does is it kind of forces you can do good architecture way back in the dark ages, as I was saying, of 94. The more the underlying infrastructure kind of forces you down the right path, the better the outcomes. And so I think one argument is that, you know, historically, a lot of folks don't architect things the correct way. And so, you know, whether it is a Puppet or a Chef that kind of puts in place good development habits, good development, struggling for the word, but basically gets people to do things the right way. Each of these kind of technologies, I think, helps folks down that path.
Sure. The way I've had it seen it described is there's the discipline approach, right? Like you could have done this without even the VM technology if you were that disciplined.
Yeah.
And then you have the tooling approach. All right, we give you VM technology and so forth. And ultimately you land with the platform approach where it's like, you just don't have a choice. This is what's going to happen.
Yeah. And the platforms need to prove that what they end up with is better.
Right.
And this is, I mean, this is also a mental shift that's happened over the last 20 years. You know, it used to be that you wouldn't trust other parties. You know, it was the not invented here syndrome as an engineering manager.
Sure.
Now, you know, if I was hearing a startup pitch and I, you know, I help advise a bunch of startups and their whole story was we're doing everything from scratch, I would kind of throw them out of the room.
Yeah, you blow an air horn, right? It's like you're not generating your own electricity.
Yeah.
Why aren't you using an existing operating system?
You're right. I mean, you better be using and all the layers above it, right?
I mean,
it's, you know, frankly, if you were building a technology from scratch and you're not using cloud technology, you know, why are you running your own database? Why are you running your own storage? Or, you know, there better be a really good reason. I mean, something you're doing better be unique.
Yeah.
That requires that. And there's very few things that are.
You remember people wrote their own garbage collectors for Java and for .NET? Sure. They were crazy.
Yeah.
Right. They said, no, you should probably trust that the relational databases you buy today and most NoSQL databases for that matter have good integrity. They work. And that the chances of you getting that right are low. That is not your secret sauce. That is not where you're providing value. And this loops all the way back to the beginning of the conversation, right? The whole thing with the cloud is you can work on just your secret sauce.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think that's true for every organization. Like, why are you building anything that doesn't represent the unique value your organization presents?
Yep. You see that in all the developer tools. Now, most folks use GitHub rather than, you know, why are you running your own software control mechanisms, right? I mean, it's a nightmare. You're putting all that overhead.
Yeah. Why would you do that?
And we see that in terms of the IT groups as well that we talk to. If, you know, go back to that story of, you know, they're doing fielding help desk requests to provision servers and add disk. They don't want to do that. That's not what an IT shop wants to do. They want to concentrate on their core, which, you know, they want to make sure that the security is good and who's using what and quotas and higher level stuff and new technologies that help the core business, not busy work.
Yes.
Which is kind of, IT had kind of fallen into that world of just being busy work, fielding help desk requests. And that's not the value that IT should be adding.
Well, that's when you end up under a CFO and it's all about cutting costs, not providing value. Right?
Yes.
Like it is a nasty trap and you put yourself in it if all you are doing is focusing on keeping the lights on, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Well, John, a half hour has kind of disappeared on us. But I do think we're kind of in a neat place of sort of understanding that we want to be here. This does seem like a transitory period. Like I got to imagine 10 years from now, the cloud architecture, maybe not the public cloud, but that approach of architecture, that's how all your systems are going to be. We're just in a phase right now where we're trying to move our existing VM infrastructure into this more modern approach.
100% agree. I mean, it's, you know, go back to my favorite buzzword. It's inevitable technology.
Yes.
Folks should be focusing on the core competence, what they need to do. I don't think I'll say all in 10 years because we still got people running Fortran and COBOL.
This
and,
is true.
You know, but certainly today we're kind of at the phase where everything new is being done that way.
Yes.
Or should be doing done that way. And most of the larger, older things are transitioning over.
Yeah.
And I certainly agree within 10 years, the vast, vast majority will be.
Yeah. We will be looking at you funny if you haven't done that yet.
Agreed.
So what's next for you? Where can folks see you? Got some conferences coming up?
We will be at PuppetConf as well. In terms of sponsoring, we will, we'll be attending AWS reInvent and VMworld.
Awesome.
I don't believe we're sponsoring them, but we'll be kind of setting up customer meetings and seminars and that type of thing. So, find us on cloudbolt.io and, happy to sort of provide more information about what we're doing.
John Middlehauser, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.